Okay, we're beginning here on the bottom of Nun Vav Amud Bet with the last piece of the Mishnah. The last line in the Mishnah says, Shlosha achim ve'echad mitzarefim mehem. If you have three brothers and one party that is joining them, so you have Reuven, Shimon, and Levi, and Kalev joins each one of them. So you have Reuven and Kalev testifying that there was a chazakah the first year, Shimon and Kalev the second year, and Levi and Kalev the third year. Ha'elu shlosha ediot. Those are considered to be three separate testimonies. In terms of hazama, they will be one edut because they only change the lachic standing in terms of the monetary obligation vis-a-vis the chazakah once all three of them have testified. So therefore you have to take out all of them in order to be a chiyuv hazama. On the other hand, they are not considered to be overlapping testimonies in the sense that the brothers do not ruin the testimony of each other. The way that the Bailei Tosafot articulated is, Sharei Ha'ed Shehid Birishona Hu Atzmo Yochel Ha'ed Bishniya. The same aid that testified about the first year, he himself can testify about the second year. We don't worry about the fact that, quote unquote, he's Nogeya Be'eduto, if he testifies about the first year, the second year, and the third year. So too, a brother could testify about the first year, and another brother about the second year. That doesn't bother us in terms of the fact that you have three brothers that are testifying to each year, if a person themselves could have done it. Or the way that the Rashbam says it is because on that which this one is testifying, Hailoka Masoid, that what these individuals are testifying, one's testifying about the first year, the other one's testifying about the second year. Their testimony doesn't overlap in the sense of they're not testifying about the same event or the same item. And therefore, each testimony can be looked at independently. For that reason, you can have this structure whereby three brothers and a third party could testify to each one of the years. Now, the Gemara wants to look at this and maybe extrapolate the din. Ha'ushtara da'bi chatima alei beitrei. This is a case that comes up in the Gemara in Ketubot and Daf Chaf Amud Bet. It's a Mishnah there. That you have a shtar that has two signatories to the shtar, and then shochim chad minayu. One of them passes away. The truth is that the case in Ketubot is where both edim are available to us. And then they come to court to testify about their signatures on the document. The question is, can they testify alone about their own signatures? Or do they need another aid to join them to testify about their signatures? Rabbi in the Mishnah over there says, each person who is a signatory to the contract can testify about his own signature, but he'll need another aid to join him. So you need two edim for each of the signatories. One of those edim can be the signatory himself. The other hand, the Chachamim say in that Mishnah that the signatory himself can testify about his own signature. So the Gemara right afterwards there in the beginning of Chaf Aleph Amud Aleph says from this you would conclude that the difference between Rabbi and the Chachamim is about what you are testifying. Rabbi believes that when you come to testify, you come to testify about the signatures themselves. Therefore, you need two edim for each signature because we don't allow testimony about anything with less than two. So you want to verify the signatures. Each signature will require two edim. The other hand, the Chachamim, who say that the signatory himself can verify his own signature, say that these people are testifying here are testifying about Moneh Shibishtar. They're testifying about the money in the shtar itself. So again, here, you're testifying about the loan or whatever obligation exists in the shtar, and therefore, you only need two edim to that fact. So if each aid testifies about his own signature, together, we have two edim testifying about the money in the shtar. So for that reason, the Chachamim allow each signatory to testify about their own signature, whereas Rabbi requires the signatory plus another aid to testify on each signature. This, as the Rashbam says, is following the position of the Chachamim, that the person who testifies is testifying about the money in the shtar. So you have this shtar that has two signatories to it, Shachiv Chad Minayu. One of them passed away. Now, in the case in Ketubot, if one of them had passed away, in that scenario, the Gemara in Ketubot says that the individual who's still alive can testify about his own signature. What he cannot do is testify about his friend's signature along with another aid from the shuk. Can't have a verification of the other signature by a single aid because he passed away already. So that aid that still remains alive will testify on his own signature. The aid that's passed away, you'll have to bring in two aidim to testify to that signature. Those two aidim cannot comprise the signatory of the shtar. The reason being is because there's a requirement that the two Edim are evenly contributing to the Edut or to the obligation that exists. If we allow the signatory that's still alive to testify about his own signature, plus testify about the friend's signature along with the third party, that would mean that three-quarters of the value or three-quarters of the obligation is changing hands based on the testimony of one individual. Because, again, the Edim on the shtar and the people who testify about the signatures are testifying about the money in the shtar. So the signatory who testifies about his own signature, he is now contributing to 50% of the obligation of whatever is written into the shtar, because he testified as his signature. Now, when he joins another aide to testify about the other signature, the one who passed away, then he's also contributing another 25%. That means that he is responsible for 75% of the movement of the money here is based on his testimony. That we can't do, because there's a requirement that the chatsi davar yedei eid echad and chatsi davar yedei eid sheni, that the total testimony comprised of two eidim is that each aide contributes 50%. So here, ata achua dahai, the koi, the brother of the one who is still alive comes, v'chad achrina, and another party, lasude achitemati adei deidach, come to testify about the other signatory to the document. So in this case, you have Reuven signed on the document, and you have Aaron also signed on the document. Aaron passed away, so Aaron can no longer testify about his signature. Reuven, who is alive, can come and testify about his signature. So Reuven testifies about his signature. Then Reuven's brother Shimon and Kalev come to testify about Aaron's signature. Kalev's an independent party, no problem. Shimon is Reuven's brother. So now that Shimon's Reuven's brother, does that cause a problem? Because Reuven is testifying about his own signature, and now his brother Shimon is testifying about the signature of Aaron who passed away. So what the Gemara suggests here is Sava Ravina, the Meimar, Ravina thought, Hainu Matnitin. That's our Mishnah. Gimel Achim v'chad mitzterefim mehem. You can have three brothers testify, each one to a year of the Chazakah, Reuven, Shimon, and Levi, and Kalev can join each of them. And it's a fine testimony. See, why can't we say the same thing over here? One brother is taking care. Reuven's taking his own signature. Shimon, his brother, is testifying along with Kalev about Aaron's signature. That should be fine as well. Amalei Rav Ashi, mi domi. How can you compare the cases? The cases are not similar. Over here, the brothers are not contributing to 75% of the movement of the obligation of the money. Hacha, in the case of the contract, nafik nechi riva de mamona apu medachai. Over here, the money is moving, 75% of the value is being contributed, obligated, determined by brothers. So the Rishbam over here makes a comment which helps us to understand this. He says, the time of the pasur rachmana krovim be'edut. Why are relatives problematic in edut? Lefish einan chashuvim keleish keish echad. They're considered to be a singular individual. So, as opposed to what you would have thought, relatives are problematic because they are nogeya, but davar, they might collude, whatever the reasons are. The Rishbam says there's just a technical problem. We view relatives as one individual. We don't view them as separate entities. Given that, you have now, if for instance, two brothers come to testify, you only have one aid. You don't have two aidim because the brothers are testifying. So now, based on that, you can understand Rav Ashi's distinction he's making. In our Mishnah, you have the case of Reuven, Shimon, and Levi. They're testifying together with Kalev. And each one of them testifies with Kalev to one of the 3 years. Now, if we were to say Reuven, Shimon, and Levi are considered one person, would that be problematic? The answer is no. That's what the Baal Tosfot told us. That the same person who testifies about the first year can testify about the second year. Or can testify about the third year. So what you have here is the brothers, who are considered to be one entity, they are contributing to 50% of the chazakah. Because the brothers, Reuven, Shimon, and Levi, if you make them into one unit, Reuven, Shimon, Levi, it's one unit, then they testify to 50% of the 3 years. Kalev testifies to the other 50%, and now you have 50-50. That's why it's fine. In our case, by the contract, you still have the same problem you had when Reuven himself was testifying about Aaron's signature. And that is now, Reuven is testifying about his own signature. Shimon and Kalev are testifying about our own signature. But Reuven and Shimon are considered to be one entity. That means now Reuven is contributing to 50% of the obligation because he's testifying about his own signature. Reuven, who is now embodied in Shimon because it's his brother, is testifying about the other signature. It means he's contributing another 25%. between Reuben and Shimon. Now you have 75% of the obligation being determined. It's the same as Reuben himself doing it. When Shimon does it, it's no different than Reuben doing it. That's what the Baal Tosafot said before. If you can do it yourself, your brother can do it as well. So just like by the Chazokah, if Reuben and Kalev testified about every year, it would have been fine. You could have Reuben and Kalev about the first year, second year, third year, and we don't consider it to be problematic. So do if the brothers change out in each of the years. It's Reuben, Shimon, and Levi. It makes no difference because we're not worried about it being the same person every year. The problem comes up in a situation like this where you have Reuben and Shimon testifying about something that Reuben himself could not testify about. Reuben, if he testified about his own signature, would not be valid to testify about the signature of Aaron who had passed away. Since Reuben himself is not valid, Shimon, his brother, will not be valid to do it because you'll end up with the same result, which is 75% of the obligation moving by a single individual. So over here, where there's a question about the shtar being raised by the loveh and the malveh has to validate it in Beit Din, that validation has to be done with the aide who could testify about his own signature, fine. And then you have to bring two separate aidim to testify about the signatory that passed away. Baal Tosafot mentioned, the Gemara in Ketubot says this, that there is another solution to the problem, which is that Reuven can sign a separate, a shard of pottery, sign on the shard of pottery, and then leave it out in the Beit Din. And then the Beit Din itself could verify his signature by matching the signatures. Therefore, Reuven would not have to testify about his signature at all. It would actually be the Beit Din that is validating his signature. Then Reuven could testify about the other signature because he's not testifying about his own signature. His own signature is being verified independently by the Beit Din by matching up his signatures in different locations. So the Baal Tosafot note that the Gemara in Ketubot actually mentions that that is a solution. Although Ravina didn't bring it over here because he wanted to have a solution that would work even without that. He says, why can't we have my brother come along and testify and maybe that would solve the problem? The answer in the end is no, that doesn't work. And that's why the only solution we have is that the Reuven would sign and they would beat him and verify his signature, and then he could be mitzaref with another aide to testify about Aaron who passed away, the other aide that signed on the document. All right, next Mishnah. Elu dvarim sheish lehem chazaka, ve'elu dvarim shein lehem chazaka. These are items that do have a chazaka, and these are items that do not have a chazaka. Pretty standard language in a Mishnah, which is a Mishnah begins with a general layout, which is that we're going to have two lists over here. One list is going to result in a chazakah, and one list is not going to, is going to result in a lack of a chazakah. We have many of those mishnayot, for instance, in the Gemara in Shabbat, when it speaks about, these are the things that a woman can wear, these are the things a woman can't wear, these are the things that a behemoth go out with, these are the things a behemoth does not go out with. And then the mishnah will enumerate the items afterwards. Over here in our mishnah, it seems to be doing the same thing, which is, it's giving you these general principles, and then it goes down to lay out the items, the pratim, the details under those general principles. The only difference here in the Mishnah is it does not enumerate, once it started the details, which of the details it's saying. Usually it would say, El Dvarim Sheish Lehem Chazaka, Ve'El Dvarim She'en Lehem Chazaka. Then it would continue again, El Dvarim She'en Lehem Chazaka, and then it would list the details under that category. The fact that it doesn't repeat it leads to a different interpretation that is brought by the Rabbeinu Hananel. The Rashbam over here quotes the Rabbeinu Hananel saying, Eil Dvarim Sheish Lehem Chazaka refers to the things previously in the Perek. Those are the items that we already saw in the Mishnayot previously in the Perek. Ve'il Dvarim She'en Lehem Chazaka. And then the list coming up are things that do not have a Chazaka. The Rishbam rejects that understanding. It says then the Mishnah becomes extremely wordy or unnecessary in what it is saying because the beginning line was not necessary at all. And then also later on in the Mishnah you'll see it'll come back and say the same thing again. Seems that it's overly wordy if you say it that way. Therefore, the Rashbam favors the explanation that these are general principles that are referring to that which is coming up prospectively in the Mishnayot. Not what we already saw retroactively. That's what the Rabbeinu Hananel says. The Rashbam and the majority of the Rishonim believe that we're talking about prospective in the Mishnah. The Mishnah is going to give you two lists. And the upcoming Mishnayot as well are going to give you additional items that fall under these categories. Haya mamid beima bechatzer. Tanur v'reichayim v'kiriyayim, u'megadel tarnagolim, v'notein zvalo b'chatzer, eina chazeka. So here in the situation, the way the Rashbam explains it, we're talking about two shutafim. We're talking about partners in a chatzer. For instance, they have a courtyard into which both of their houses open. So they are partners in this chatzer. one of the partners of the chatzer goes ahead and utilizes the chatzer in the following manner. He brings his animals into the chatzer to graze, to stay. He keeps them there. Tanur v'rechaim, he brings in an oven, the rechaim, the mill, and the kiraim, the stove. Umegadel tarnagolim, he's bringing up chickens. V'noteins v'alo b'chatzer, he's putting his dung to compost in the chatzer. Eina chazaka. None of these establish a chazaka. The reason being that these are what we call usages that are awry. These are temporary or mobile usages. They can be moved in, they can be moved out. There's nothing permanent about this utility. And since these are shutafim, these are partners, partners are not going to be makpid on each other when it comes to this type of utility, because these are the ways that you use the chatzer. But if they were to do something more permanent, then we would worry about it. Based on what the Rashbam is saying, there are two things to note. One is the Tanur Rechaim and Kiraim that we're speaking about here must be smaller stoves, ovens, as well as the mill and the Kiraim, the stove, that they have to be smaller. The way it goes is the Rechaim Shalyad. It's a hand mill. But they have to be small enough that they're movable, because if they're ones that are cemented or plastered into the ground, then already they become a permanent fixture. That's very different than what we're speaking about. So we have to be speaking about smaller items that are movable. For that reason, you can't establish a chazaka, because the usage would not raise an objection from the other party. Since the other party won't object, the lack of objection is not an indication of the fact that you are establishing a chazaka. From that, you would also conclude that if it was a third party coming in and utilizing it in this way, they would be able to establish a chazaka, because it seems to be that the reason you aren't makpid over here is because of the fact that you are shutafim, that you are partners in the chatzer. That means if it's an outside party, a third party that's coming in and using it, there you would be able to establish a chazaka. The chazaka that we're speaking about here, according to the Rashbam, is the 3-year chazaka that we've been speaking about all along in our perek, which is that if you do this for 3 years, we would have thought you establish a chazaka. So there is an alternate view. I'll wait till the second half of the Mishnah to indicate the alternate view. Aval, asam mechitza lebemto, he put up a wall or some sort of separation pen in there for his animal. Gevo asarat tfachim, that's at least 10 tfachim high, which is the minimum shiur for a wall. V'chein letanur v'chein likirayim v'chein lerechayim. Similarly, for an oven, a stove, and a mill, whether that means putting up a wall, whether that means that he plastered them in, or he put them in a permanent fashion. Ichnis tanagolim letoch habayit, or he brought chickens into the house. Vasa makom lezvalo. And then he makes an area to put his dung, but not just to compost it there, but he's amok shlosha. He digs a depression in the chatzer 3 tefachim deep, or he creates a platform 3 tefachim high on which to put it. Harizo chazaka. That can establish a chazaka, because over here, the actions that he's taking are permanent changes in the utility of the chatzer. He's putting in things now that have become fixtures of the chatzer. They're not just temporary, not things that you can kick out anytime you want. These are items that are now permanent fixtures of the chatzer. If the other individual, the other shutaf, does not object to that, then there must be an acquiescence to his utilization of the chatzer in that manner, and he has gained the rights to that. If he claims that either I bought it from you, or I gained those rights from you, the 3 years of chazaka would establish a chazaka, because we would have expected an objection here. The lack of objection is an indication that it must be true what the individual is claiming. Now, that's the view of the Rashbam. The Rimi Gash, as well as it seems that this is the view of the Geonim before the Rimi Gash, is that the establishment of the Chazakah is not based on a 3-year basis, but rather on the fact that the type of utility is offensive or obvious immediately. It is that a person in a Chatzer walks in and out of the Chatzer on a regular basis. He sees it. It's not like he's going to be surprised in 3 years from now that this thing is here. It's there on a daily basis. And therefore, if he walks in there, and this is an item that's been put in permanently, after a very short duration, whatever that is, whether that's a day or is that a month, whatever it is, it's clear that this is not a temporary structure. If he doesn't object, the other person gains the right of usage. It's not that he's making a claim on the rights for the property. According to the Rashbam, the person is indicating he bought the rights, or he owns this part of the chatzer, and therefore he can use it in this way as he pleases. And that's what he needs 3 years to establish. Over here, they are getting an easement of usage. That the Rimi Gash says it's all about that this person has a right of usage. So that would be independent whether it's the shutaf or it is a third party coming in. It would be indifferent between that, because the whole question here is, would someone grant usage like this? The answer is no. Since somebody would not grant usage like this, if they do use it that way, that establishes a chazaka. Not, you don't need 3 years for that. You just need it a short period of time, where it's clear the person is doing this, not just on a borrowed basis, or someone offered them the opportunity to do this, they're setting up shop here. And if they do that and you don't object, that's a clear indication they must have that right of usage here, and therefore you can't throw them out afterwards, or they can say that I purchased that right of usage, and you no longer have a right to stop them from using the chatzer in that manner. Right, so now Gemara says, Maishna Reisha or Maishna Seifa. What's the difference between the Reisha and the Seifa? Now, we articulated it based on the conclusion of the Gemara, but what's the difference between the list and the Reisha, whereby you cannot establish a chazaka, versus the list and the Seifa, the Mishnah, whereby you can establish a chazaka? Amar Ula proposes, Ko shilu b'nichse ager kana, b'nichse chavero kana. Anything that would work to acquire the property of a ger, or period, acquire any property, meaning that it is functional to do, now gadaru paratz, the kinyan is created through that action, then you can also establish chazaka through that action. If it's not a sufficiently strong action for you to acquire the property of the ger or in any transaction to establish a chazaka, then that also will not allow you to establish a chazaka of 3 years. So here is the first blurring of the terms chazaka that we've seen and we've been separating between throughout this perek, which is that we know that the word chazaka is used in two contexts. It's used in the Mishnah and Kiddushin, which is there are three ways to acquire real property, kesef, shtar, and chazaka. That chazaka we already define as nal gadaru paratz. You need to do some activity on the property that demonstrates ownership, but also improves the property in some way. The chazaka that we've been speaking about in our perek is the 3 years that a person, if he utilizes the property over that period of 3 years, he no longer needs the shtar to prove the fact that he has a claim to the property. If he says, I bought it, and he's been there for 3 years, that can replace the need for a shtar. So that's the different types of chazakot. What Ula does now, it says that they are connected. The two overlap. And that is that in order for the action to be significant enough in both situations, that is both significant enough so that you can acquire the property through a chazaka, that'll be the mechanism of kinyan, that type of action is also significant enough to establish the 3 years of usage, and vice versa. If it's not significant enough to be the mechanism of kinyan, it also will not be significant enough in order to establish a chazaka of 3 years. And therefore, he says in our Mishnah, the first half of the Mishnah, all the items that are mentioned there are items that are utilizing the property, but not impacting the property itself. You're not doing anything to the land itself. Since you're not doing anything to the land itself, you can't make a claim for the land. On the other hand, in the latter part of the Mishnah, where you build something, a mechitza, you dig a ditch for the composting, you do all these things that are improvements or work on the land, there you have a mechanism for kinyan because you've done an action on the land that also will establish a chazakah. So Ula blurs the lines between those chazakot and says that the same one that works for the acquisition, the mechanism of acquisition, will also be the one that works in terms of the 3 year chazaka to replace your shtar. So that which we've been saying all the way until now is that they were separate. Ula now says they're not so separate. They both are doing the same thing, which is they're establishing your rights to the property. One of them is doing that by being the mechanism of the kinyan. The other one is doing that by replacing the need for evidence of your kinyan. As the Rashbam notes over here, Uminyan a kinyan ade ma'ot matanahi. Obviously, you have to have a kinyan through ma'ot or matana. You have to have a reason that you have it in your possession, and then you establish the chazaka by using it for 3 years. So now we have a question on that. Is that really true? Matzkifla Rav Sheshet, Miklolohu? Is that principle really bulletproof? Vare nir. Dimnichse ager kana, ubnichse chavero, lo kana. Wait a minute. You have a plowing of a field. You plow the field and leave it fallow. That plowing of the field by nichse ager will be an establishment of ownership or a mechanism for kinyan. You've improved the land. So your plowing of the land is no different than nal gadaru paratz. You've done something to the land itself, improved the land. You have a right through that to acquire the property. On the other hand, b'nichse chavero, if you do that for 3 years on your friend's property, you do not establish a chazaka, lo kana. Doesn't work to replace the shtar. Doesn't help you with the 3 year period. The reason being, we saw this back earlier in the Masechta, which is that by plowing on your field, the owner can make a claim. I'm happy for you to plow my field. You improved my land, and I'm going to go take my land back, and I'm going to use it. You did nothing that caused me a loss on the property. You did something actually to improve my property, and that's, I'm more than happy to let you do that. It's not your property, but if you want to help me out, go ahead. I'm not paying you for it, and I'll take it back when I want to use it. You've gained no benefit from the property. On the other hand, the opposite way. Varei achilat peirot, when it comes to the eating the produce of the land, diminichsei chaveiro kana. In the case of establishing a chazaka for 3 years, that will establish a chazaka because you are utilizing it like an owner. You are taking the production of the field, which is the monetary value of the field in a sense, which is the production, and now you're eating it or you're taking it. That taking of it demonstrates ownership in terms of replacing of the shtar for the 3 year period. On the other hand, benichsei ager, when it comes to acquiring property, that you want this to be the mechanism for acquisition, lo kana. Over there you are unsuccessful at being koneh, because all that you did was you affected the peirot, which are things that come off the land. You never took action on the land itself. You never improved the land. You simply picked the production of the land. Like we saw before by the woman, who was cutting the branches of the palm tree to feed her animals, and then the other guy came afterwards and did a little hoeing underneath. And we said that it goes to the one who hoed underneath, not to the woman who's been picking fruit. Picking fruit is not a mechanism for kinyan because you lack the improvement on the property. Whereas hoeing the property, that's an improvement on the property. And again, vice versa, in the case before, plowing the property is a clear improvement in the land, but it's not a demonstration of ownership because you're not causing a loss to the Baalim, you're actually giving them a benefit. And so they have no reason to object over there. So where we expect someone to object is in a situation where money or value is being taken from their property. If they don't object, that's a clear indication of ownership. Whereas when you're trying to establish a kinyan or use the kinyan through the chazaka, you have to do something to the property itself. And that's how the Rashbam summarizes it. Hizkat shloshanim shetalui bikpeida. When it comes to the chazaka of 3 years, it all has to do with being makpid. When will a person be makpid and when will a person not be makpid? If he would be makpid and he doesn't object, the failure to object is an indication of the other party's ownership. In a case where he wouldn't object, then his lack of objection is because he doesn't care or it's not necessary to object, and you can't prove anything from that. The chazkat kinyan, when it comes to establishing a kinyan through a chazaka, nixei ager shetalui b'tikun hakarka. That all has to do with improving the property. So what Rav Sheshet points out is that you are on two different tracks. Like we've been saying until now, the chazaka of shloshanim is different than the chazaka that is used in a kinyan. There may be cases where they overlap, but that's only because the reasons for them overlap, not because there's a real fundamental overlapping between them. And in that way, he rejects Ula's explanation. Now, the truth is, and the Rashbam notes it as well, is that they could have rejected Ula's position from the Mishnah itself. Because the Mishnah in the latter half mentions a number of items where you do tikkun hakarka, but there is one item there that is not tikkun hakarka, which is he brings the chickens into the house. Said if he brings the chickens into the house, that establishes a chazaka. Over there, there's no improvement in the property. So that should be a fundamental question on Ula's connection between the two. Over there, we say it is a good chazaka, yet there's no improvement in the property itself by him bringing the chickens into the house. So the Rashbam in the end explains, v'haydalo parich lo, how come they didn't ask from that? Mishum da'difa minei kaparich of Sheshet. Rav Sheshet had a better answer or better questions. He wanted to bring more fundamental questions rather than a question from our Mishnah. He wanted to prove from other sources that this is a problem, not just in our Mishnah, but it's not a principle that stands, period. It says some people want to explain that when you bring chickens into the house, that would be a chazaka by nechse ager. Why? Because that's locking up the house. When you bring the chickens to the house, you got to close the door, otherwise the chickens are going to leave. When you close the door and lock it, that's now bifnehem. The lav miltahi. That's not a case. Dinlat delet lav chazokahi. This is the Rashbam l'shitato. That locking the door does not create a chazoka. Remember that a machlok between the Balei Tosafot and the Rashbam. The Rashbam said that you have to put a lock in, or you have to change the lock for it to be a chazoka. Balei Tosafot say simply locking the door would be a chazoka. So over here, the Rashbam says if you just lock the door, that's kilu machriachari. It's like chasing away an ari. That's not doing anything that's changing the dynamic of the property. Just keeping damagers or thieves away. It's not doing something to the property. So then the Balei Tosafot would say your prevention of access is a demonstration of ownership and a improvement or change in the property stance. Therefore, the Balei Tosfot would think you can acquire it in that way. The Rashbam thinks you cannot acquire it that way. And therefore, the Rashbam believes over here that they could have had a better answer. You could have had this answer. They just had a better way to slug up Ula. So they didn't bring this question from the Mishnah. Although for the Balei Tosfot, you could have argued that there is a reason to believe that Tarnagolim are not a question over here because of Na'al Bifanav. And they would have worked over here to uphold the position of Ula because he locked the door. That works by Nechseger. It's also going to work here as a Chazakah. So now the Gemara says, based on that, can't say that that's the distinction in the Mishnah. Elo Amar Rav Nachman, Amar Rav Avua, this is the distinction in Mishnah. Hocha b'chatzer ha-shutafin askinan. Here we're talking about a chatzer of partners. We already explained the Mishnah this way because this is the conclusion of the Gemara. Ba'amada kadi lo kapte. The shutafim, when you just do temporary items, or you bring in things that are temporary uses of the chatzer, they're not mapid on each other. Because he knows that anytime he wants, he can have him remove it because it's not a permanent structure. Amachitza kapte. You put up something that's a permanent structure, that they are makpid about. So the question is, what's the threshold for hakpada? That we said before is what establishes chazakah. Chazakah is where you should have objected and you didn't object. So that's what Rav Nachman says, is the Mishnah is telling you where that threshold for objection is. When you have partners in a chatzer, when you do something that, even though it's a utilization of the chatzer, and it does interfere partly with his usage of the chatzer, but since it's something that he can have you remove at any moment, he won't object. He's not going to bother unless he really wants it or he wants you to clear it out. So he could leave you there for years doing that without any problem. On the other hand, if it's something that is a permanent structure in the chatzer, where he can't have you remove it immediately or just get rid of it, then if he does not object, that's a clear indication of acquiescence, because otherwise he should have objected immediately. And that's what Rav Nachman says is the difference in the Mishnah. By Tosafot over here, note, didn't we say earlier in the Gemara that a shutafim cannot establish a chazakah one or the other? That's what we saw in the Mishnah. Shutafim can't create chazakot because their rights to the property or their usage of the property is not demonstrating ownership. It might be just they're utilizing it within the context of the shutafut, in the context of the partnership. If you have a right to be there, then you can't establish a chazakah because the other party may not be objecting because of your right to be there. Baya Tosafot give two answers. One answer is similar to what we saw earlier in the Gemara. Depends on what he's trying to take possession of. Kula or Chetzia. And the Gemara over there had it both ways. Depends what he's trying to acquire. But if he's trying to establish ownership over areas, either uniquely use one half of it, or he's trying to use the entirety of the Chatzer, which is overreaching his position as a Shutaf, then you could establish a Chazakah, and that's what our Gemara must be speaking about. Or he says, maybe there's a difference between a Sadeh and a Chatzer. When you're shutaf in a sadeh, over there, maybe you can't establish a chazakah because the nature of usage isn't as obvious or in front of you all the time. And you, even if you extend your reach, it's different. But over here, by a chatzer, where it's right in front of you, and it's something that you use daily, and you, it's obvious the reach of the other partner where he's taking advantage of the situation, if you don't object, maybe that is problematic, even if you are shutafim. So here, for the Rashbam, it's particular to shutafim. This whole experience here is shutafim. In particular, don't have this hakpada or do have this hakpada. Of course, if it's a third party coming in, then no question you would have hakpada about it, and that would cause a problem if the individual left them there. Everybody would agree, whether it was temporary usage or permanent usage, that would be problematic. According to the Rimigash on the Mishnah, who explains that the problem here is with you're utilizing it in a way or getting an easement to use it in some way that should be, is offensive enough that you should object. And if you don't object, you lose rights. If by the Rashbam, it's only by Shutafim that this whole differentiation is relevant. For the Rimigash, for sure, by Shutafim, if you utilize the property in this way, that usage will establish a chazakah, because the type of usage that we'd expect someone to object to. If you don't object to it, you're going to lose it. Again, for the Rimigash, in a faster pace, you're going to lose it at 30 days or even faster. Whereas for the Rashbam, you would need the 3 years in order for that to be the case. All right, so now the Gemara says, Uba amada kadi lo kapte. Are people not worried or not makpid on just utilization of the chatzer in a way, either traversing the chatzer, utilizing it in a way in a temporary manner, doesn't have permanent structure, is that really true? Va'atz nan. We have a Mishnah in Nidarim that says, Shutafim shenadru ana'a zemizeh. You have shutafim, partners that took nidrei hana'a, not to benefit from each other. Asurim likanes lechatzer. They can't enter into the chatzer. Why? Because each one of them owns a portion of the chatzer, and when you walk into the chatzer, you're utilizing my half of the chatzer as well. The Mishnah in the Darim, there's a massive run over there that discusses all the positions of the Rishonim, and as to why do we say or don't say Breira in these cases, and why can't we say that there's Breira, and therefore he's using his half of the chatzer. So there the Rambam discusses why there is Breira or not Breira in certain circumstances, and why the Breira here might be different than Breira in other places in Shas. El Amar Rav Nachman, Amar Rav Avua, Hacha B'Rechava Shachorei Abatim Askinan. Gemara now is forced to change its position and say that a chatzer, we do worry about Hamada. People are makpid, not only on permanent structures, but even on utilization of it. That's because in the chatzer, you enter and exit from it every day. You bring your things in to unload, to load up. It's an area of activity all the time. And therefore, even if people put in their animals for a short period of time, for a couple of years, they're leaving their animals there, that's going to be a problem. If you don't object, then it's clear that you let them do that, because that would be a type of usage that would impede on your ability to use the chatzer. And so therefore, we'd expect you to object, and that's the same reason in the Darim, that you can't enter the property. Any type of usage, even minimal usage, people are makpid on, because this is their front yard, this is their main entrance. But, rechavash achorei abatim, the courtyard, or basically the backyard, even if you have a shared backyard, over there people are not as makmid, because that is an area that is less used. And since it's less used, ba'amada kadi lo kapte, ba'amachitza kapte. When you just use it in a temporary manner, people don't worry about it. If you put up walls, you start doing buildings and structures there, people do worry about it. So in solving the problem here, the first answer of the Gemara is to distinguish between different courtyards. There's a courtyard in front of the house, which is your active courtyard. That's where you're going in and out all the time. In that courtyard, you're going to be makpid on everything, because you don't want someone impeding your usage of the property. And that's why in the Nedarim, the Mishnah Nedarim says if you take a neder anah from each other, you can't even walk through there. Even the smallest amount of akpadah is meaningful. On the other hand, in the backyard, over there where there's much less use, you go out there much less. In that situation, then, if they do something that is temporary in nature, you're not going to be makpid on it. If you do something that's permanent in nature, they will be makpid on it. So our Mishnah is talking about the backyard. The Mishnah in the Darim is talking about the front yard. Rapapa Amar, Idi V'Idi B'Chatzer Shutafim. Both of them are talking about a Chatzer Shutafim, the front yard. V'Ika De Kapte, V'Ika De Lo Kapte. Some people are makpid on small items or on temporary usage. Some people are not makpid on temporary usage. So then, what do we do? Gabe Memona, by monetary manners we go, Lekula. Gabi Yisura, Lechumra. By Yisur, we go Lechumra. So let's start with the Yisur. The Yisur is Nedarim. By Nedarim, which is a problem of Yisur, if you violate the Neder, then you're in violation of an Yisur Do'oraita because of your Neder. Over there, we're going to say some people are Makpid, some are not. We don't know whether this person is Makpid or not. Therefore, we're going to assume he is Makpid, and we won't let you traverse the courtyard, because maybe you are getting Hana'ah, because he's normally Makpid. And if you do it, despite the fact that he would be Makpid, that would already be a usage of hana'ah that would violate your neder. So in that case, we take the precaution and say, no entering into the chatzer when you've taken a neder hana'ah. On the other hand, by mamona, by monetary matters, the way that the Rishbam explains it is, that generally a shoel shalomidat is considered to be a gazlan. You borrow something without permission of the other party, you're classified as a gazlan. Over here, when you walk into the chatzer, do you ask permission from your partner every time you walk in the chatzer? The answer is no. You don't ask permission. What does that show you? You're not a shoel shalomidat, because they're not makpid. What it shows you, what it demonstrates is that there's an assumption that you are not makpid, and therefore you don't need to ask permission from the other party. Once you assume or establish the fact that you're not makpid, then the lack of objection doesn't show you anything. The person's not makpid, then his lack of objection is because he's not makpid, not because he thinks you're the true owner. And so what it says is by mamona, it's clear by the fact that you're allowed to enter there without asking permission, or utilize it without asking permission of your partner, that you are not a shoel shalomidat. You are a shoel midat because the other party must not be makpid. If he's not makpid, then we're not going to assume that there's an objection. Others say that mamona lekula just means that we keep the chazaka the way that it was prior to now, which is that until now they were partners in the chatzer, equal partners in the chatzer. This individual is trying to establish a chazaka to change that dynamic. We're going to say, we have a safek, we don't know if the lack of objection was meaningful over here, therefore we're going to leave the things in the status quo. We're not going to change it over to your ownership. We're going to leave it as the previous ownership, which is 50-50 between the partners. You didn't gain anything, and that would be the kula. That's the other way to express it. But either way, you have a difference between mamon, between the matters that are found in our Mishnah, and Iser, where the matters are found in Nidarim. So despite the fact that you're talking about the same area, because it's a safek, because we don't know where that threshold of hakpada is for people, by Iser we're going to go to Chumrah and say you can't go in there. By Mamona we'll go to Kula and say you don't establish a chazakah. Now even though, for instance, the Gemara is going to say later on that this doesn't matter whether it's a chatzer that can be split or can't be split, and in a chatzer where it can't be split, you can't stop someone from walking in there, despite that fact, when you take a neder hana'ah, it has the ability to override that. Because otherwise, why do you have a right to block someone's access or usage of a chatzer? So the Baal HaTosafot explain over here, it's similar to someone who is a landlord and rents out the house to someone. When he rents out the house to that party and he's makdish the apartment that he rented out to you, Hekdesh takes it over and the guy who's in the house got to move out. How could he do that? You're the renter right now. But because you have a certain amount of balut over here, you are able to exercise those rights over the balut and cause problems for someone else who has a rights here. And so just like by the renter, you can exercise your rights even though it hurts the other party. So it's over here, by a chatzer, which you're sharing and you can't split. Even though the other guy has a right to go through there, you can exercise your rights even to his detriment. And you can be a makdishit or you can make a neder that will prevent him from utilizing it. So that's how you're able to do that and prevent the other party from using it. Third answer is, Rabbeinu Amar, olam lo kapte. Our assumption is that people are not makpid on this. So since people are not makpid on this, you can't establish a chazaka, because this is the type of usage or utility, which is not, people are not makpid on temporary type of items, things that people bring in and out, even if they're for long duration, people aren't makpid, therefore you can't establish a chazaka. Ah, so why in Nidorim, or is it problematic? V'amani Rabbi Eliezer, the Mishnah in Nidorim is authored by Rabbi Eliezer, Tanya. Rabbi Eliezer Omer, afilu vitur asur b'mudar ana. Someone takes a neder ana and restricts himself from getting hana from another person. He is not only asur in items that are clearly gifts or benefits that you're garnering from a friend, but even in things that the person does for everybody, but since it's a give up to you, it's a problem. The example that they give basically is a baker's dozen. Whenever you go into the bakery, everybody who goes into the bakery, when you buy 12, they give you a 13th. For free, because that is the way the baker does it. Or it's a volume discount. If you buy 100 eggs, he's going to give you 2 more eggs just because you bought 100, 102. Is that unique to you? It's nothing to do with you. If another guy, if 5 other guys came in here and did the same thing, he'd give them the same gift. So it has nothing to do with you. You're not getting hana because of your friendship. You're simply getting hana because of the fact that that's the way business transactions are done. So according to the Chachamim, that's not a problem. Because he's not treating you differently than any other customer. He's not giving you hana'ah that anybody else wouldn't have gotten. There is no hana'ah here. This is the natural business. When you pay 100, you really get 102. Or in essence, the price is lower for 100 than it is for 99 because of the discount. Or the price is lower for 12 than it is for 11 because once you buy the 12th one, they give you a 13th free to reduce the price. So given that, the Chachamim say there's no problem by neder hana'ah. Rabbi Lezer says no. Even that little give up, it's considered to be a na'ah that we're makpid on. And that's what he says over here. People are not makpid on you traversing through the property or utilizing it in a way that's not permanent. So for a chazakah, we don't expect him to object. His lack of objection is because he's not makpid. With regards to a na'ah, we have a higher standard. That standard is not just that you're not makpid. The standard is, are you getting anything? And even the slightest thing that he's giving to you, even though he would give this to anybody, if anybody walked through there, he wouldn't care. Nevertheless, because it's you and you're gaining, even though it's a minute type of hana'ah, it still is classified as hana'ah. That's why the Mishnah in Nidarim says asur in that case, because it follows that opinion of Rabbi Eliezer. Now, Amar Rabbi Yochanan Mishum Rabbi Bana. So Rabbi Yochanan now brings something in the name of Rabbi Bana. It's significant because we're going to spend a lot of time now with Rabbi Bana. Even though it may not relate to our Masechta directly or to the topic at hand, the first statement obviously relates to our topic at hand, but then we're going to segue into other things that Rabbi Bana said. I'm Rabbi Yochanan Mishum Rabbi Bana. B'chol shutafim ma'akfim zetze, chutz min ha'kvisa, shein darkam shubnot yisrael itbazot al ha'kvisa. So here he says that when it comes to shutafim, they have a right of objection to you utilizing the property in any way, with the exception of this one item, which is that they can't stop you from using it for laundry. He can stop you from using it in any way if he doesn't have a quid pro quo. Say, I'm not going to put an oven here. You can't put an oven here. I'm not going to put my meal here. You can't put your meal here. He has a right to object, and that right is not overreaching. It is his right as a shutaf in the chatzer, with the exception of one thing, which is that you're not allowed to stop him from doing laundry in the chatzer. The reason being, because ein darkan shebenot Yisrael litbazot al kvisa, because we don't expect the Jewish women to denigrate themselves by doing the laundry. There are a number of factors here. First of all, the first item is that the women did the laundry, and it was extremely hard work. It was extremely difficult work. It was almost a whole day's labor, exhausting and very hard work. It is the case before the advent of washing machines that hand washing and the process of washing was very involved and very difficult, and was something that was done by the women of the household. The women, the daughters, the girls of the household used to do it. So now you have choices about where to do the laundry. Do you do the laundry in the courtyard, or do you do the laundry down by the river? So what he is saying here is that we don't want the Bnei Yisrael to go down to the river to do the laundry. We want them to be able to do it inside of the chatzer. The reason being is that going down to the river exposes them because of the nature of doing laundry. When you have to wade into the river to do the laundry, the way that the Rashbam explains it is, Tzarichot amot sham yechefot. They stand there barefoot. They have to go into the river and they're there barefoot. Ligalot shok lamod benar. And they have to expose their, seems from the Rashbam that he's talking about a calf over here, but whether it's the calf or the thigh, they have to expose their legs in order to go into the river. They don't want their clothing getting all wet, so they roll their clothing up, and they go barefoot into the river, and they're exposing their legs when they go into the river. So now they have to compromise on their tzniut to do the laundry in the river. The way that the Rabbeinu Gershom explains it is, Afilu nachriot mishum shomdot yechefot umigalot zrootehem. They stand there barefoot and they expose their arms. They roll their sleeves up in order to do the laundry. Given that, we want to protect the tzniut. So we don't want the women of Israel to compromise on their modesty by having to go down to the river. So therefore, it's a given that in the chatzer you have a right to establish a washing basin, assuming that it's the women that are doing it, and assuming that it's not on a commercial basis, it's for their personal needs, and it's not affecting the other half of the chatzer, they're not dumping all their water into his half of the chatzer. Given all of those caveats, they have a right to put in laundry, even if other shutaf in the chatzer doesn't want it and objects. They can override that objection, because this is a takanat chachamim, protect the modesty of the Bnot Israel. Now the Gemara continues and says, V'otzei meinav mira'ot bira. Person who closes his eyes from seeing bad. Amar Rabbi Yechir Baba, Zeh she'im mistakel b'nashim b'sha'a shomdot ala kvisa. This is someone who doesn't look at the women while they're doing the laundry by the river. So over here, you see the connection before, which is that the reason we want to allow the girls to stay in the chatzer is so that they're not on the river. Because here you have a drusha on the pasuk of someone who closes his eyes for not seeing evil. Is someone who doesn't look at the women that are laundering on the river. That means that there's something wrong, or there's some compromise or debasing of the modesty of the women when they go and launder by the river. Hey chidomi. So now the Gemara waits, so wait a minute. This statement of Rabbi Abba that you're supposed to not go by the area where the women are laundering, what's the case? If you have another way to go, meaning you have another alternative, rashahu. This guy's a Russia. He had a choice to go a different way, even if it's longer, and avoid coming across these women, and yet he walked this way anyway. Forget about closing his eyes. He should never have gone there. The fact that he chose to go this way, that makes him into a Russia. If there's no other option for him to walk there, anusu. What do you want from him? He's an anus. He needs to walk through that area. He needs to traverse that area. So why should he have to otzemeinav? Why does he have to close his eyes? It says, olam, deleka darcha chrita. There is no other alternative. This is the only way that he can go. Despite the fact he has to make extraordinary efforts to look away, to not look, to close his eyes, to try not to gaze, despite the fact that you're compelled to go through there, you shouldn't be taking it all in. You shouldn't be looking or intentionally looking. You should just avoid or avoid your glance from seeing these things. How far that goes in terms of menas nafshei, does that mean that he should look down, even though it's going to cause him problems, he's going to trip on the path, that might be one extent. Or, is he supposed to look where he's going, he's just not looking anywhere else? That it's a question about how far you take this, but it's definitely a midot chasidut. But it's a midot chasidut that the Navi, based on this interpretation, is extolling. Something that you should be doing, which is otzei meinav mirod bira. Someone who closes his eyes from seeing bad or seeing evil, this is something that is complemented by the Navi and something that we should strive towards doing. So even though you have to go or drive to places where they have billboards with things that are not always tsanua, so you're not going to say if there's no other way, then you have to go there. But given that, you're not supposed to be gazing and looking at the billboards. You just drive as if you're driving normally. You don't take in everything that's around you. Over here, it doesn't necessarily have to be Jewish women that are laundering in the river. Over here, the Rabbeinu Gershom says it was non-Jewish women that were laundering in the river. So you don't have an ability to establish a takana to stop the women from laundering in the river because these are non-Jewish women. So there are situations or circumstances where you don't have control over the environment. Given that you don't have control over the environment, you have to deal with the environment, but in a way that, first of all, if you have a choice to avoid it, even though it might be the longer route, and if you do have no choice, and that's the only way to go, then you have to make your efforts not to look at all. So what's interesting over here, what's interesting about this is the Rashbam himself was a very big chassid or tzaddik, and he used to walk around with his eyes down all the time. He never used to look anywhere. He was the Rabbeinu Tam's older brother, and we know that he was also a Rebbe of the Rabbeinu Tam. The Rabbeinu Tam said about his older brother, the Rashbam, "Achreiti anvatanuto sh'Rabbeinu Shmuel." I experienced tremendous humility and modesty of my older brother. So his brother, Rabbeinu Yaakov, the Rabbeinu Tam, once made fun of his older brother, the Rashbam. He said that the Rashbam was so makpid and such a chassid that he didn't look around. He didn't want to look up because he didn't want to see any women. He didn't want to see anything that was immodest. He never looked up. So they were going somewhere once. They were getting into a wagon or a chariot that was going. But because he was so tsanua, he didn't look up. He walked with his head down and walked straight into the wagon. The Rabbeinu Tam is said to have said there, "Amarlo, al tehei tzaddik harbei. Don't be such a great tzaddik. Salam arom enecha. Lift up your eyes. You're about to be pulled in this wagon by Kilayim." So the Rabbeinu Tam, in a sense, was prodding his brother to not be such a great tzaddik, because his modesty now was going to lead him to an Iser Kilayim Deoraita, rather than just a Midat Chassidut of looking down all the time. And his brother, the Rabbeinu Tam, starts to make fun of him and says that your Chassidut is leading you to a situation in which you're going to violate an Iser Deoraita. Had you looked up, you would have noticed that the animals pulling the wagon are kilayim. And so meantime, you're avoiding all this immodest wear, and the animals that are pulling the wagon are kilayim. His brother's complimenting the Rashbam on his great chassidut, but he says it went so far as to the fact that he didn't even notice when he hopped into a wagon that was going to be pulled by kilayim. So that's Rabbeinu Tam talking about his brother, the Rashbam. But you see, the Rashbam took this to an extreme, or in a sense that he wanted to avoid any look or gazing at immodesty. Therefore, he kept his eyes down all the time. Again, the Gemara doesn't define for you what it's considered to be the requirement over here. The Rashbam simply says, La totenav mitzad acher, just look the other way. Don't look in the direction that they are, look the other way. Whether you have to look down, again, whether you have to do it to the extent that you might trip or you might cause yourself some problems by looking the other way, that's a question of how far this goes in terms of being a chassid in these situations. Baminei Rabbi Yochanan Rabbi Bana. So here is the segue into these topics where we're going to speak about Rabbi Bana. Rabbi Yochanan queries of Rabbi Bana, Chaluk shel Tamid Chacham Ketzad. The clothing of a Tamid Chacham, how should it look? The Chaluk is basically the equivalent of the undergarment of the Chacham. What should it look like? Ko she'ein b'sero nireh mitachtav. As long as you can't see any flesh, you can't see any of his skin under it, that's a good undergarment for the Tamid Chacham. The way that the Rashbam learns over here is that it should be long enough. The cloak should be long enough that if the Talmud Chacham is walking barefoot, that the undergarment here, the tunic, should reach all the way down to his feet so that nothing is exposed when he walks. So he's completely covered when he walks. You have it be long enough so that you don't have that problem. Because Talmidei Chachamim are very makbid on tzniut, and they don't want to expose anything. So this is definitely a midat chassidut, where he doesn't want to expose anything. He doesn't even want to expose his feet, his ankles, his legs. He doesn't want to expose anything. For someone who is an Amaretz, who is less makpid on tzniut, over there he might expose his feet, or he might let a certain amount of exposure, which is not problematic. It's just not a midat chassidut of tzniut. That's one way to learn it. The way that others learn it, like the Rambam, is that the undergarment, this chaluk, should not be see-through. It means that you can't see the skin under it. It should be thick enough. The weave should be thick enough that you can't see through. It's not see through the chaluk. Talit shel tamar chacham keitzad. So now the tunic, which is the undergarment, which again they walked around in, they also had a cloak that went on top of it. So the cloak of the tamar chacham, how should that look? Kol shein chalukol nireh mitachtav tefach. It should be, the cloak should be big enough that there's no more than one tefach of the chaluk, the tunic, sticking out from underneath it. So the talit should be of equivalent length and no smaller than a tefach difference between that and the chaluk. Now you might want to make the cloak a little shorter because otherwise it'll get dirty when it rags against the ground or caught on things when you go through the ground and it's much more expensive. Or the sleeves, they'll get dirty when you reach into things. So there are reasons to make the cloak smaller than the tunic. But if you're going to go to the extent of making the tunic so big or so lengthy that it covers everything, then as far as the cloak is concerned, you could leave up to a tefach difference in space, but no more than that, because that's not considered to be proper dress or proper modesty in dress. What is seemingly being stated over here is that these are the proper mores of society, that a talmid chacham should always go out in a manner that is befitting his stature. And so therefore he should wear things like the nobility would wear. He should dress in a manner that draws respect from the way that he dresses, and not dress in a manner that is like the common people, or a manner that is not sanua in nature. Shulchan shel talmid chacham keitzad. How does the table of a talmid chacham look? Shnei shlishei gedil, v'shlish gelai. 2/3 woven, and 1/3 exposed. So the Rashbam over here brings two different interpretations. He says, first of all, the gedil refers to the tablecloth. It's not exactly a tablecloth, because if you remember in their day, coming up to Pesach, the Mishnah in Arvei Pesachim tells us that they had personal tables. So we're speaking about here personal tables. We're saying we had the cloth that goes on that personal table that you would also use as a napkin. So the question is, how does the Talmid Chacham's table look? So the way that the Rashbam explains it in one way is that the 2/3 of the table that are closer to him have the tablecloth on it. The 1/3 that is away from him is exposed. The reason for that is that on the 2/3 that are closer to him, the tablecloth being there gives him a way to wipe his face, to use it as a napkin, and also to place the bread and other items on it so they don't get ruined or they don't affect the table. On the other hand, for the third that's further away from him, on there you put the dishes or the serving dishes or the pots that are brought out with the food on them. So that way, if they spill or if they're hot, they don't ruin the cloth under them, but they are further away from the person who is eating. So that would be proper etiquette. That's one way the Rashbam explains it. The other way the Rashbam explains it is that you put a cloth around the whole table and the center is left open. So around the edges, you have your food and your tablecloth and your napkin. And in the center is where they put the pots and the serving dishes again, so it doesn't ruin the cloth. That is the shulchan of a talmid chacham. Balav, karot, v'yerek. And on that part, you put the serving dishes and the vegetables, the things that would dirty the cloth. You keep them on the part that is exposed, not by the tablecloth. The part by the tablecloth, you keep the bread and you wipe yourself and you use that part for where you're eating. Okay, so again, this is an etiquette issue. V'tabato mibachutz. The ring for the table should be on the outside. The ring is the ring by which they used to hang up the table on the wall. Remember, it's a small table. It's for one person. It's an individualized table. When they were finished with it, they used to hang it up on the wall, so it didn't take up all the space. The way that they ate were on couches, and then they had the tables that were brought to them outside. So if you want to open up that space or make it usable again, you hang the tables on the wall. Or if you have less guests than normal, you don't bring out all the tables. You only bring out the necessary tables. The others are hanging on the wall. So now you hang them on the wall by this tabat. The tabat was on the edge of the table. At either end of the table was the tabat. So the suggestion, the proper etiquette is to have the tabat be towards the outside. That way it doesn't interfere with your eating. It's not between you and the food that's on the table. V'atanya tabatobi mifnim. Don't we have a braita that says you should put the ring or the hanging ring towards you? Lokasha. Hadika yanoka, adaleka yanoka. Depends if they're little children or not. If there are small children, then you put the ring towards the outside so that the children don't grab it and shake the table or pull the things off the table. If there are no little children, you can put it on the inside. So if there are no children, you put it on the inside. If there are children, you put it on the outside. Bibaitema. Some say, Havaha, Daleka Yanoka. Both of these are cases where there are no children. Dokasha, the Ikashama, Hadaleka Shama. Depends if there is a servant or there is some sort of waiter that is coming back and forth. If there is a waiter, then you keep it on the inside. So even though there's some discomfort for you, you can manage it because you know it's there and you're always interacting with it. the shamash was going back and forth and in and out. He could bump into it. He could trip over it. It's difficult for him to maneuver through all those different tabot. So you want to keep it on the inside because he's in motion and you are stationary. Both are cases where you have a shamash, or someone that's serving, a waiter that's serving. Depends if it's during the day or at night. During the day, you can see the tabat sticking out, and therefore you can avoid it. During the night, where it's dark, even though there are candles there, it's harder to see, and he won't be able to avoid it, and he'll bump into it and cause the table to spill over. So therefore, it's better to put on the inside. So each one of these answers indicates that sometimes there's a reason to put on the outside, sometimes to put on the inside. Now, we prefer it on the outside because then it doesn't interfere with your ability to eat. But given the fact that there are trade-offs or mitigating factors, sometimes it's worth the inconvenience of putting it on the inside because of the difficulty it would cause by putting it on the outside. Mishal Amaretz, the table of an Amaretz, domeh l'medura. It's like a big pyre, because they wrote makifotota. And therefore there is, like you put stones around a big fire banner, medura. So too, all the pots are around the outside. He puts the cloth in the middle, and he puts all the serving pots and all the other stuff on the outside. Or others say medura, which is like a big pyre, where everything just gets thrown in. It's a big chola. So too, his table is just mixed up, everything everywhere. There's no seder to the table. Now, the distinction, as you've noted already, is not a distinction between a Talmud Chacham and an Amaretz. It's a distinction between those with manners and etiquette, and those without the proper etiquette. The only thing that the Rabbi Benoah is saying is that a Talmud Chacham should conduct himself based on the etiquette or the manners of the time. And that's very much borne out over here, as well as in Arvei Pesachim and in the Gemara or the Tosefta in Brachot, whereby the Tosefta lays out the proper way to eat, the proper etiquette to eat. It was based on the time period that they were living in. It's the Roman way of eating, but there's a certain etiquette to eating, and a person should follow that etiquette and be considered a mannered individual. And that's what Rabbi Benoah is saying, is that the Talmidei Chachamim should align themselves with mannered individuals and conduct themselves with manners, and not like the Ami Aretz, who don't have any of these manners or etiquette that you would assume because they're considered to be uncouth. And given that, we want the Talmidei Chacham to differentiate himself and act in a manner that has proper etiquette. Mitashil Talmidei Chachamim Keitzad. So Rabbi Yochanan again inquired of Rabbi Benoah, how should the bed of a Talmud Chacham look? Kol she'ein taktecha ela sandalim b'imot ha'chama u'menalim b'imot ha'gishamim. Underneath the bed should only be his sandals in the summertime and his shoes in the wintertime. Now the way that the Rabbeinu Gershom explains it over here, and the Rashbam says the same thing, is that in the wintertime they wore their sandals because the roads were muddy and there was dirt and everything everywhere, so they didn't want to ruin their shoes. So they wore a sandalim, because you can always wash your feet. The shoes were more expensive. In the summertime, they wore shoes because it was dry out, and therefore it was harder surface. So they wanted the shoes to protect their feet, but they also wouldn't get dirty, so they walked with shoes in the summer. It's counterintuitive. Today, people wear sandals in the summer, shoes in the winter. They were doing the opposite. And therefore, what it's saying is that during the summertime, your winter shoes are the only thing under your bed. And in the wintertime, your summer shoes are the only thing under the bed. In the summer, you keep your winter sandalim under the bed. And in the winter, you keep your summer shoes under the bed. That's the only thing that should be stored on the bed. So just know that other places in Shas, Rashi notes it to be the opposite. That you wear sandalim in the summer and shoes in the winter, like we would say. And therefore, the Gemara here will be saying the only thing you keep under your bed is the shoes that you're using currently. That means in sandalim in the summertime, because that's what you use. And in the wintertime, your shoes, because that's what you're using. Here there are two possible pronunciations, Otzer Balum or Otzer Balus. Rashbam Amir favors it being a Samach, which is Otzer Balus. And he says the word Balus means like Isa Blusa, means mixed up of all sorts of things. It's a big cholent, a big storage area, and he stores all his things underneath there. This goes to a Gemara that we saw in Pesachim, which says that a person should not store food under his bed, because under his bed there is a ruach ra'ah. Therefore, a Talmud Chacham limits what he puts under his bed, whereas an Amaretz puts everything under his bed, despite the fact that there's a problem of ruach ra'ah that is shora under the bed. So a Talmud Chacham, abiding by the Gemara and Pesachim, should not keep anything under his bed besides his shoes because of the ruach ra'ah. The Amaretz, who doesn't or isn't makpid on these things, doesn't worry about these things, puts everything under there, including food, which is problematic because of the ruach ra'ah. And that is the main issue that is here. On the other hand, the Rabbeinu Gershom seems to favor the Girsa of it says in Otzer Balum. Dome the Otzer Balum, Kotzer Amachal, Shminichim Bo Rov Minim. It's like a big pantry of food in which he keeps all his food. The Rashbam calls it, he keeps everything there, including the food. The Rabbeinu Gershom focuses on him just storing the food there. But either way, it's problematic because of the Ruach Ra'ah, the same way that prior to washing Negel Vasser in the morning, where you have Ruach Ra'ah in your hands, you're not supposed to touch the food or parts of your body because of the Ruach Ra'ah. So over here, under the bed, which has a Ruach Ra'ah, you shouldn't be storing food items. And that's, again, Rabbi Benoah's explanation to Rabbi Yochanan about the conduct of a Talmid Chacham. This is the proper way that he should conduct himself. Again, we'll stop here by the two dots on the top of Nitzchad Amad Aleph. And tomorrow we'll learn a little more biographically about Rabbi Benoah.